Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Fort Lauderdale author Dawn Davies opened up her life in the memoir Mothers of Sparta. Her story takes readers on a journey across the country and the state of Florida as she details her life raising children in poverty and at times as a single mom. She tackles her experiences dating and finding love and raising a child with special needs. Now, Davies finds humor in these challenges and is often vulnerable with the readers about the most intimate details of herself and her family. Mothers of Sparta is the Sundial Book Club selection for this month. You can always join the book club by finding us on Facebook and searching Sundial Book Club.
I never set out to write a memoir. I wanted to become a fiction writer. And as a lifelong reader, I felt like getting an MFA would give me permission to write creatively myself. I wrote for 10 or 15, 10 years professionally for other people. And then I decided to go back to school to get an MFA. And I went in and think, I'm going to be fiction all the way. And what they didn't tell me was that the when you first sign up for classes that first semester is that the things fill up really quickly. And I should have gotten up at midnight. And when they opened at midnight, I should have signed up. But I slept through the night. I got up the next morning. I went to sign online for classes and no fiction classes were available. And I was forced by default to sign up for this nonfiction writing place, like a place writing course with very wonderful Madeline Blaze. She's a very good nonfiction writer. And I went in almost under protest. I did not want to do this. I don't belong here. Who wants to write a stupid nonfiction anyway? I mean, and then she had me hooked that first class. And I immediately changed to nonfiction probably within a week in my brain, you know. And then I decided everything that I wrote for her in that beginning semester, I would try to make meaningful and make work. I wasn't just playing around. I was old. I was in my 40s when I went back to school, so I wasn't messing around. And I just went in and thought, how could I cohesively write what she's asking me to do, which is inward reflection of myself, and try to make it into something, which is also uncomfortable because when you don't ever think about being a memoirist, who wants to hear about me, you know? It was a weird shift.
This book is a collection of essays. I wonder, did you write these essays separately and later bring them together as a book? Or did you think of like the project as one big book, just many stories?
So that's a good question because it's structured differently from regular memoirs. It's structured almost the way like a collection of personal essays would be. And they all seem to make sense near each other. But memoir is usually linear. There's usually a chronology to it. And I didn't set out initially, probably the first year, to write a memoir. I just thought, I got to write all these essays and get these things published. And then the more I organically kind of got into what I was doing, I thought that, let's see if I could make this work in the way that when you look at some person's life at the end, when you retrospectively look at somebody's life, all the little pieces of the things they do or the things we do when we're examining our own lives, all those pieces put together a whole. So I wanted to try to do that probably very consciously starting in my second year. I did that.
It's like a tapestry.
Yeah. Well said.
The early essays are about you as a child. One of the things that we learn is you moved around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I loved, for example, how you described it. Basically, it's the day would come, you walked in, your parents are sitting there, let's talk. And it was, well, we're about to move again.
Yeah.
And that happened a lot?
It did happen a lot. My dad was he was with a company and he kept moving up in the ranks of this company. And they just, I think it was like every 2 years, I could be wrong, when I was a kid. It was, for me, it was every 2 years. My sister was 5 years younger. She stopped moving when she was about six or seven. So she didn't have it. But honestly, it was probably every 2 to 2.5, 3 years that we moved.
So you never had the chance to like really build friendships anywhere because you had to leave eventually.
I did. And I think about that a lot too, because, it's going to sound terrible on air. I don't have a lot of friends and I don't care. I have some really good friends and the friends who I have know who they are, but I don't need to see everybody. I had one best friend one time, and then by high school it was done. And I don't know, I feel like it made me go inward, and that contributed to my type of thinking, which contributed to my obsessive reading, which contributed to my desire to write. So I think it turned me into who I am now. So I guess it's okay, but it was tough as a kid.
People who live in Florida, a lot of us, and I'm one of them, we're transients. Mm-hmm. We came here from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And you just end up here. But it's always that, well, what's your impression when you get to Florida? And it's always interesting. And you had this beautiful way of describing, because you had gone from what, from Virginia to New York, then you went to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
That first impression of Florida for you wasn't really pleasurable.
No, it wasn't, because I was angry we were leaving. I didn't know anything
about
Florida.
And you did it in the winter, right?
We did it in the winter. So we moved, my parents moved us during the winter break so I could start at a new school fresh in the January semester. So, which is very nice, you know, it was a good time to do that. But I got here like, what is this place? This place, these aren't trees. What is this? It looks like Dr. Seuss, right? It smelled funny, and it was so hot, and my hair did bad things, and so it took a while. It grew on me slowly.
Okay, let's do a little reading from the book, and this is from the essay Three Places. Before you jump in, just tell me a little bit about what you're going to read here.
Okay, so this essay is the second essay in the book, and it's about moving around a lot and moving from place to place and having a connection with the places where I lived. I really care very much about how things smell, how they look, how the outside feels, what the wind sounds like. That all resonates with me. So even as a kid, I was really interested in going out in the woods and feeling the nature of a place, right? So it talks about the nature of these places, plus the nature of the people in those places. And then by the third place, we get to Florida, and it's when I first moved here. And it's just a geographic and social shock to move in.
All right. I'll move out of the way and let you read.
Your mother moves into a small, cheap apartment on the other side of town. And you, your body, your mind, your soul, feel as empty as the house you are left to live in. When you come home from school late, the house is empty. The lights are off, and there's no more promise of meatloaf or casserole in the air. But instead, mildew and dust, which have been waiting for the right opportunity to take hold and strangle you. In Florida, the outside is always trying to get in, and dank Florida smells are everywhere you go, stifling and wet and spongy. Pool chlorine and suntan oil and salty air and fish. Black tar heating on the ribbons of suburban driveways. Gardenia and night jasmine that make you wheeze. It is unbearably hot everywhere you go, hot like you think hell would be hot. In fact, you begin to suspect that you are in hell. Your head is so chronically stuffy that you begin to lose your balance when you stand up. Once in desperation, you take a Benadryl before school, and this makes you so sluggish that you fall asleep while watching a film strip in biology. The room is dark and warm, and you nosedive off the high metal stool and hit your face on the floor. Your lip splits. You are the lady shaver again. Okay, so I should say that the lady shaver is a reference to, I showed up to school on my first day in my Florida middle school after having gone through and scraped my face on the side of our new pool. That was new to me, that we were swimming in January. That's how you know you're not from Florida, when you go swimming in the winter, right? But I just like, oh, it's 72 degrees. Let's go swimming. It sounds great. And I swam and I scraped my whole lip, the top of the lip and the bottom of the chin up on the side of the thing. So I had to go to school my first day with Band-Aids all over my lower side of my face. So all the kids called me the lady shaver for 4 years.
In the chapter called Fear of Falling, you recount your experiences as a mother. You're having these thoughts of death of you and your baby. You have paranoid thoughts as you're going through. You're dealing with postpartum depression, right?
I was dealing with postpartum OCD.
Okay.
And they didn't know. And I didn't know. And I've since discovered that I have OCD. And I look back on my life, I'm like, oh, everything makes sense now that I know that I have obsessive compulsive disorder, which I actually think makes me a better writer. But it flared very, very hard. So all those things that I had were very obsessive, intrusive thoughts. So at the time, we thought it was postpartum depression. At the time I wrote this, I still thought it was postpartum depression.
Is it, I mean, at that time, is it just something that wasn't talked about?
So they talked about it somewhat, but I was afraid that, you know, they'd say, you have to go on medication or we're going to take your kids away. Because at the time, like... There was that fear.
That you weren't a fit mother, they would take
right.
your kids.
Right, and, you know, people with postpartum depression or postpartum OCD or any type of postpartum issues, they're not bad mothers. I mean, we can technically do bad things that are bad for the kids, but you should never be afraid of reaching out to get help if you have postpartum issues when you have a baby, because, I mean, it's I don't know what to say. It's very profound. It's very scary while you're in the moment, and you want the best for that baby.
It's almost like you envisioned the worst thing that could happen, and you felt it as it was happening, even though nothing happened yet.
Right. And that's part of OCDs. You get these compulsive, you know, you get these thoughts that happen, and you can't get them out of your head. And like, it'll even tell you, like, if you stop thinking about it, something bad will happen. So you have to honor. I mean, it folds within itself so many different ways. It's fascinating and exhausting at the same time.
Did you just say a second ago that your OCD makes you a better writer?
Yes.
How?
Because I think I'll think it, and then I'll think it again, and I'll think of an aside of it, and I'll think of an aside of the aside, and then an aside of the aside of the aside. And I think it gives me more depth. And also, you go over it, so it's hard to explain because people have different types of OCD, but right. One of mine is the fear of having somebody misunderstand something that I write, and then something bad happening as a result of them misunderstanding what I write. So, I write something about postpartum depression, and then somebody does something and it's a bad thing that they do as a result from reading with something I wrote. So I think really carefully about all the things that I write. And I also make sure that they sound a certain way next to the certain sentences in front of them or behind them. And I think all writers do this anyway, but I'm very thorough when I do it. And so that's, I guess, one of the gifts.
We're talking with Dawn Davies. She's a South Florida author, and she wrote the book Mothers of Sparta. It's the January book for our Sundial Book Club. If you'd like to read it or learn more about the book club, just find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And you can always share with us what you think about the book or even ask questions to the author and tell us what else you're reading. Let's get back to our conversation. When you write a memoir, you're sharing intimate details of your life, and I wondered, is there ever a moment where you stop and think, I don't need to tell everybody about this. Why should I share this? Mm-hmm. Or are you open to it and you felt, yeah, let everybody know. I want to tell everybody everything.
So that's a really good question. Memoirs talk about this all the time. There are classes, there are workshops for this. People talk about it. We talk about it constantly because it's an issue. So, you know, you bleed in, you write something about yourself, but that sometimes bleeds into writing about other people who don't ask to be in your story. You're writing about family, you're writing about friends, and it's not fiction. It's real life. So there are people who, you know, sometimes you have to ask them for permission. So the question is what do you do with that? Because you're writing something about yourself and you're putting it out for readers. One thing that happens when I meet people who've read my work, they, oh, wow, I feel like I know you so well. Like, I feel like you're my best friend. And the secret part of me is like, well, you really don't know much at all. I very carefully control what it is that I say about myself. And it's under the umbrella of the persona, right? So all nonfiction writers, when they write about themselves in terms of it, their self being a character. Yeah. So even when I talk about my work to other people who are, you know, to other people who are writers, I talk about the character. I don't say me. Do you understand?
Right.
So
right.
We have a protective layer called the persona that we create and that we can craft. It's not a lie. Everything you say is true, but you write with yourself as a character in mind.
Do you do that also with the other people in the story? Again, I mean, these are real people.
Mm-hmm. No, I tend to try to write. Everybody becomes characters, but I also have to think very carefully about how I represent other people. I don't care what people think of me. I've written some essays that, you know, people, I've gone to some book groups and stuff and some, you know, some older ladies who, I did a book group at a church once and they were very offended by the men I would have slept with essay, which is, you know, and when you look at that as what it was, which is an exercise and fooling around with, objectifying men and having this just a wild mind, you know, they didn't like that at all. And they were very upset by it, you know, but I don't care what people think about me. They can think what they want about me. But when I write about, like, you know, I do write about my kids sometimes. I care very much about what people think about them. So, you know, it's a slippery slope. I have to be careful. I don't name my children. A lot of people get through the book and realize, oh, I never heard a name of anybody who's in this person's life, in my life.
I want to get to the essay, Mothers of Sparta. And, you know, this one, profound for me. Again, there is a personal connection on some level. I do have family who sort of have this issue, but you have a son.
Mm-hmm.
he was diagnosed autistic.
Mm-hmm. That's what he was diagnosed with.
But also, and I want to make sure I get this right, that he also was diagnosed as having a frontal lobe brain damage.
That's what they said after they did MRIs. And he also had seizures for a few years.
He had complications from at birth.
Yeah, he did. And he was actually, once turned cyanotic, he stopped breathing about 30 minutes after he was born. And turned purple and all that stuff. And he spent a few days in the NICU. He actually had a cleft palate. So they think that he was choking on the mucus. But they didn't see the cleft. Whoever went in, they felt the cleft palate, but they didn't look in the mouth. It was a submucous cleft. It was in the back where the muscles are, where the uvula is. And so all you need to do is look in there. You could see it. But they didn't see it. And so they let it go. Ordinarily, they probably would have taken him away and made sure he was suctioned properly or whatever. So, you know, I'm not a litigious person. And life would have been so much easier for him if I had sued somebody, you know? I don't do that, though. Do you know? It's. I look back on all the ways that I could have done things better had I known what I know now. But you don't know. You're flying by the seat of your pants when you have a child with this disabilities.
Yeah. And then he eventually had a surgery.
He had surgeries, yep.
Mm-hmm. And but so at what point was he diagnosed autistic?
So I noticed signs of things that were not normal when he was about two and a half. And so he did some early intervention stuff. And then I think he was five when he was finally diagnosed. And they just said autism spectrum.
But what is this frontal lobe brain damage? What is that exactly?
So all I know from neurologists that we've talked to is that he had frontal lobe, he had seizures there. And they said, based on what they saw and his behaviors that he exhibited, which are tended to be in the impulse control area and executive functioning, where he had trouble doing basic life management stuff like, keeping your room clean, following a certain order of steps, being on autopilot, doing those things like brushing your teeth and just basic stuff like that. And he also had his main problem was impulse control. So he had a very, very hard time putting off what he wanted to do right then from an early age.
Reading the story as he's growing up and some of the things he's doing, and, you know, I mean, as sad as it was, because it seemed like no one at the schools could do anything for him at all. They just thought that he was being disrespectful or that he was being a troubled child. But really, mm-hmm. he was struggling with so many things. And they didn't spot that. They didn't see that.
No, they didn't. And so we were in Broward County at the time. And there's no love lost between me and Broward County Public Schools. I really did try. We tried a lot of different ways. And I think that there's a certain type of person that falls between the cracks when you're not like in an inclusive classroom, when you don't need so much supervision that you need to be when you're verbal, when you can talk, but you, I don't know, he shouldn't have been in regular classes, and no one ever got that. I tried very, very hard. He needed an aide, you know? And by the end, we finally had some testing in high school, and he was probably in, I think, 11th grade. And I said, we got to do something. He's failing everything. He's failing basic functioning here. Can we do something? And I had something in mind that I wanted to do involving sending him to a special school. And he was denied that, you know, even though his testing pointed to every single thing that I said was an issue, it came out, he was red flagging everything that on the test.
Well, because there was that, then the things that he was doing at home, and from a very early age, he was telling you he wanted to die.
For a brief time, he did, because he was not successful with anything in school. I feel like, you know, it's not the school's job to make your child happy or to make your child functional. It's the family's job. But I think we have to work together with them, because it takes both. And he would, you know, go to school. And at the time, he was getting picked on very heavily, really bad stuff. They were really bad. And if he retaliated with a behavior, which most kids do when they're little, whatever the last thing was that anyone saw was the one who got in trouble. And he was always that kid who got in trouble. So he came home after school on any given day feeling extremely unsuccessful. And he was 12 or 11 or something. Nine? He might have been nine. We were having trouble in school. And he said, I just want to die. I don't know what else to do.
Well, how old was he when you started to find the issue with for him going online?
Yeah.
And some of the things that he was looking at online.
So that was probably 12.
12 years old.
13, yeah. And, you know, he said that he was actually at a special school for, you know, that is equipped to handle people on the autism spectrum. And he met a friend, and the friend was his little gateway and showed him something. He went to his friend's house to play, and the friend was kind of hooked on it. And he showed him, and it was like a heroin, like, you know, whatever drug you take that first time you get addicted, it was like that.
A lot of parents have said this. I mean, the book has helped them in so many ways. I wonder the conversations you have with other mothers about maybe some of the stories that they can relate to you in so many ways. If what are those conversations like?
It's funny because this was the essay that I least wanted to publish, but I also felt like I felt like a publisher, I'm selling my kid out in order to have people read my work, you know. But I spoke with my son about this, who had turned 18 right around the time it was, you know, getting ready to be published. And I said, you know, we can do this or we can scrap the whole thing and we won't do it. And he says, Mom, if it helps somebody else, then put it out there, even in all of its hideousness, because the essay talks about some really horrible, hard things that I thought of as a mother, you know. He thought, maybe it'll help someone. And I thought, everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket with this. You know, it's going to be really bad. Bringing up is going to be bad. My son's going to be doxxed. He's going to be targeted. I'm going to be targeted. You know, I'll never work in this town again. You know, one of those things. And actually, I did find that it did seem to resonate with a certain group of parents. And they're all online. Like, I don't even know anybody locally who has some of the issues that we had. But it's this, there's a disorder called conduct disorder, which people under the age of 18 would be diagnosed with when they have a specific set of behavior problems. And that was the community I found where people were like, oh, yeah, oh, that's all your kid did? You know, my kid did this, you know? And so there's a whole group of very, very thirsty, angry, frustrated, desperate parents out there who have children whose needs are not being met by psychologists, by MDs, by school systems. Just like us.
Don Davies, again, the book is called Mothers of Sparta, a beautiful collection of essays. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you so much.
Again, that was my conversation with this month's Sundial Book Club author, Don Davies, author of Mothers of Sparta. If you want to read along, it's not too late. Join our book club on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. It's free. Ask to join. We'd love to have you. By the way, if you are reading the book, tell me what's your favorite essay. I'm going to post mine up a little later this afternoon. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, January 14th. Remember, there is no Sundial tomorrow because of the school board. We're going to play some of our best of. But coming up on Thursday, we're going to do a deep dive into the issue of child sex abuse. We're going to look at video games and online chat rooms. And also, there's a new law in New York that's affecting kids here. We're going to do that all up coming up on Thursday. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you later.